Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have the Philippines, Malaysia, and Indonesia moving forward with plans for a joint anti-terrorist task force. Philippine President Duterte announced that everything had pretty much been agreed to and that the only thing left to do now is to formalize the prospective agreement. According to him, this will open up his country's borders to the neighboring military forces, which could imply that they'd also do the same for his forces and their own with one another, potentially creating a semi-integrated military space in what has come to be known as the Mindanao-Sulawesi Arc. This concept was first popularized during the 2015 Shangri-La Dialogue Conference in Singapore, when a Philippine representative warned that it could become Daesh's next international hotspot. The area that it encompasses is relatively isolated from all three national governments involved because it sits at each of their peripheries, but it's also at the confluence of the Philippines' Mindanao-Sulu Island conflict with the Abu Sayyaf terrorist group, Malaysia's problems with weapons of mass migration in its far eastern state of Sabah, and the ethno-religious tensions that had previously broken out in Indonesia's island of Sulawesi. This combination of factors, mixed with each respective country's previously more prioritized security focus on the more densely populated areas within their borders, led to an enticing situation for cross-border militant groups to exploit, as began to happen this summer when a local Daesh affiliate teamed up with its regional allies to lay siege to the southern Philippine city of Marawi. The battle is still raging even 100 days later, and the ferocity with which the terrorists have resisted the Philippine military's attempts to liberate the city have sent chills all across neighboring Malaysia and Indonesia, which suspect that some of their nationals are involved in this fight. It's perhaps this event, more so than anything else, which served as the much-needed and long-overdue catalyst for all three states to put aside any regional distrust that they may have had towards one another and combine forces into the prospective anti-terrorist task force that Duterte recently spoke about. And they're doing this in order to ensure that the situation doesn't completely spiral out of control anytime soon. If it does show any signs of doing this, then it can at least be the case that conflict could be confronted right away by the joint military forces of each country. Even so, there's a lot of work that will need to be done in the future in order to turn this instrument into a cohesive and coordinated one for ensuring regional security. So it shouldn't be expected that the three sides will all of a sudden seamlessly commence effective anti-terrorist operations together. Moreover, there will still be concerns about national sovereignty, such as which units can enter each other's territory during a hot chase, how long they can be there, and how far they're allowed to penetrate. And these limitations could hamper the working efficiency of the group. Be that as it may, however, the Joint Anti-Terrorist Task Force is a strong step in the right direction, and it'll hopefully reduce the chances that Daesh will destabilize the region in the future. The next one up is how the Syrian Arab Army is on the verge of winning the dash for Deir ez-Zor. The race for Raqqa might have long been over ever since the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces reached the northern edge of Daesh's so-called capital a few months ago, but that didn't mean that the battle for northeastern Syria was anywhere close to finished. So long as the besieged desert town of Deir ez-Zor remained under the terrorist occupation, and the small contingent of Syrian Arab Army troops heroically held out there for the past couple of years, then Damascus always had a shot at regaining most of its sovereignty in this corner of the country. Even so, none of this could have been taken for granted, as the Kurds have been racing through the desert to attack this town just as they've done with Raqqa, all with the intent of capturing it so as to increase the odds that they can either annex it to their self-declared federation or trade it back to Damascus in exchange for the central government recognizing their autonomy. Now, though, that plan has been dealt a major blow ever since the Syrian Arab Army beat the Kurds to Deir ez-Zor. Though there is the possibility that the Kurds might still launch their own uncoordinated operation against it from the north. Either way, however, the point is that Damascus stopped the Kurdish advance south and beyond the Euphrates, and that it now has the chance to even cross the muddy river downstream in achieving a bridgehead that could later be used for liberating the Kurdish-occupied territories if the order was ever given. That's what the Dash for Deir ez-Zor was always about, determining the post-Daesh battle lines between Damascus and the Kurds. and whether it would be the natural border of the Euphrates, or if one side could get a cross-river advantage against the other, like how the Kurds did with Manbij and Topkapi further upstream. The reason why all of this is important is because it will play a role in deciding Syria's internal political arrangement after the war. To elaborate a bit on this, the Kurds want to create a de facto independent, sub-state, federalized, or internally partitioned political entity all to their own, which perfectly overlaps with the US's plans for entrenching its existing military presence in the heart of the Mideast via a proxy entity such as this one. If the so-called Rojava of northeastern Syria could be strategically linked with the newly independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq, then the US would succeed in its quest to establish a wide belt of forward operating bases at the pivotal crossroads between Syria, Turkey, Iraq, and Iran, which in turn could enable it to indefinitely continue functioning as the most destabilizing divide-and-rule actor in this crucial region through the consecration of the second geopolitical Israel of Kurdistan. However, if Damascus emerges victorious in the dash for Deir ez-Zor, then it has a chance to dismantle the illegal, pro-American, federalized entity on its territory so long as it can acquire a beachhead presence on the other side of the Euphrates River further downstream afterwards. Third on the countdown is Trump's decision on DACA. What the president ultimately decided to do was take a flimsy middle ground approach to this issue, thereby disappointing his base in order to earn insincere praise from his erstwhile most vehement critics. Trump pledged on the campaign trail to do away with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, immigrant policy, which postponed deportation for 2 years for hundreds of thousands of people who illegally entered the country when they were minors, but only if they were enrolled in school or fit other criteria after undergoing rigorous background screening. Trump supporters saw the Obama-era policy as a soft amnesty, while his enemies said that it was a compassionate thing to do. It appears as though Trump has come to sympathize with the latter, since it's taken him this long to even make a decision on it, after having previously gotten his base's hopes up that it might have been one of the first things that he'd do once he stepped into office. Approaching this from a pragmatic perspective, it does indeed make sense for Trump, who is known for his orderly business habits, to want an interim period between the abolition of this policy and the formation of a new one within what he decreed to be 6 months' time in order to calm what are the overhyped fears of a chaotic, large-scale deportation campaign. However, the political costs of doing so also need to be calculated into this equation. Trump is clearly uncomfortable with the multi-sided pressure that he's come under by the deep state, the Democrats, and RINOs, or Republicans in name only, ever since he became president. So this concession of sorts should be seen as a way to relieve some of that burden from his back. But at the same time, it would be naive to believe that it'll put a stop to the anti-Trump campaign, because his enemies won't rest until it's either impossible for him to govern or he's out of office. Trump's political tactic in giving his enemies what they want in order to buy time for himself or create breathing space isn't working, and it's also aggravating his base, who is sympathetic to what he's going through but growing increasingly frustrated at the games that he's apparently forced to play. They know that it's extraordinarily challenging for him to pass through the legislation that he wants, but on something such as DACA, which could be easily done away with by executive order and without his enemies being able to stop him, some of them are disappointed that he decided to sit on the fence and pretty much postpone any decisive action on it until later, possibly hoping that he can trade this for some other political deal in the future. It also doesn't augur well for building the wall either, since some people now worry that if Trump's going to go weak on DACA, that the wall with Mexico might be the next political casualty in his war with the deep state. Our runner-up is the spectacular and likely fake news that Somalian terrorist group Al-Shabaab has apparently captured a uranium mine and plans to sell its nuclear materials to Iran. This extraordinary story broke over the weekend when it was revealed that the Somalian foreign minister sent a letter to the U.S. ambassador to Somalia, warning him that this was happening, pleading that the U.S. must redouble its military commitment to the country because, quote, "Every day that passes without intervention provides America's enemies with additional material for nuclear weapons," end quote. Surprisingly, even the U.S. government-run Voice of America expressed doubt about the veracity of the story that the foreign minister was selling, interviewing experts who noticed certain contradictions and exaggerations in his account. It's safe to assume that the claims of Al-Shabaab selling uranium to Iran are false, but it's important to analyze why Somalia would promote something so ridiculous in the first place. To begin with, Somalia cut off ties with Iran in early 2016, on the same day that it received $50 million in aid from Saudi Arabia, so it was already hostile to Tehran to start out with. Al-Shabaab is definitely on the upswing, and it doesn't help any that Ethiopia has largely pulled out most of its forces in the country. Kenya is hesitant about sending more, and the African Union mission there is mostly ineffective at stopping the terrorists. So Somalia's new government that was inaugurated earlier this year might have thought it useful to play the Iran card in trying to convince the US to do more on this front. Washington has thus far played an occasional role in Somalia through drone strikes, special forces raids, and military advisors, but that's the extent of how far it's willing to get involved. Somalia's other partners don't seem interested in helping much either. Saudi Arabia is its largest aid donor, but doesn't care about the country's stability. Both the UAE and Turkey have military bases in the country, though the former are being built in the northern breakaway region of Somaliland without Mogadishu's permission, and neither wants their citizens to die just to save Somalis. And Qatar, with whom Somalia still bravely retained relations with despite heavy Saudi and Emirati pressure, doesn't have the military capacity to help even if it wanted to. Therefore, in pursuit of Somalia's own self-interest aimed at halting the spread of Al-Shabaab's gains in the central part of the country, Mogadishu thought it fitting to concoct a fake news story about its hated enemies, supposedly being on the brink of selling nuclear materials to Iran in violation of the 2015 agreement, hoping that this would be sufficient enough to trick Trump into reacting against the terrorists with the same type of fire and fury that he threatened North Korea with. The problem with this approach, however, is that it doesn't account for the fact that Al-Shabaab cynically serves an important role in American grand strategy by being an indirect hybrid war tool against China's new Silk Road investments in Ethiopia and Kenya, and that while the US does fight it from time to time, it thus far has no real reason to exterminate it. At our top spot, we've got the Xiaomin Declaration that emerged from this week's BRICS Summit in China, and how it's important both for what it includes, but also what it doesn't. There were a lot of platitudes spread throughout the text about the need to enhance full-spectrum integration between the BRICS countries, strengthen economic governance institutions such as the G20, and reform international political organizations like the UN, but there are also a few passages that are very significant and deserve to be paid some extra attention to. In making the best use of our limited time, let's talk about some of the broader things that the BRICS countries agreed to, and then focus a bit on the important inclusions and exclusions in their joint statement. For starters, the concept of BRICS Plus is clarified a bit, as being the BRICS outreach and cooperation efforts with emerging markets and developing countries, which is broad enough to even pertain to Russian Valdai Club expert Yaroslav Lisovolk's proposal from earlier this year for each member to include their institutional spheres of regional influence into the bloc. The BRICS countries also decried what they termed as inward-looking policies and tendencies, which is a euphemism for protectionism, and strongly deplored North Korea's H-bomb test. They all threw their support behind the African Union and regional continental organizations in resolving the crises in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Libya, South Sudan, Somalia, the Central African Republic, and Western Sahara, and signaled unspecific concern over the situation in Yemen. The most important inclusions have to do with the Syrian and Afghan peace processes, which the BRICS countries say should be Syrian and Afghan-led and owned, and they lauded the Astana and Moscow peace processes for each respective conflict. Altogether, it increasingly looks like the Syrian conflict resolution model is being applied towards Afghanistan, though with less success as of now. Another major inclusion in the Xiaomin Declaration was a list of terrorist groups that were mentioned, which included some Pakistani-based ones that are already declared illegal by Islamabad. Some Indian voices thought that this signaled a kind of victory for New Delhi, but if anything, it was to Pakistan's benefit because it emphasized that the country is on the forefront of the global war on terror. To conclude with the notable omissions from the joint BRICS statement, it was significant that Mali and the terrorist groups located there weren't included in the list of ongoing African conflicts, nor were Nigeria and Boko Haram. In addition, there's no clear reason why the BRICS countries couldn't come to a unanimous agreement about adding even a vague reference to Venezuela in the Xiaomin Declaration, although they did so for Yemen despite Russia and India's growing ties with Saudi Arabia and China's excellent ones with the kingdom. And finally, The most glaring omission of all from the document was that there's nothing directly stated within it about China's One Belt, One Road global vision of New Silk Road connectivity, which was probably done on purpose in order to avoid irking India as part of a prospective deal over the Donglong, Doklam Plateau. Right, folks, well, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly wish each and every one of you a very nice weekend. Hope you guys will tune into the program next week. Take care, and bye.